Hey folks, and welcome to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. I'm your host, Mishki Katkoff, and in this episode, I'm joined by my friend, John Wright, who is VP of Publishing at Quali. And you guessed it absolutely right. In this episode, we are going to talk about publishing because I think publishing has experienced a little bit of a renaissance. So the times of self-publishing are not over, but much more limited due to two main things. So privacy changes, as well as the pinch on overall investment. So you have less resources that you can raise to scale. Now, I think this is a super fun conversation. As always with John, we recorded this on site. So sound quality could be a little bit worse than before, but the video quality could be a lot better if you're watching this on YouTube. And if you want to meet with John, you can actually on Think Games Istanbul, 7th of March. John will be one of the speakers. There's a link in the description below where you can sign up to join us at our annual Istanbul event, one of the biggest game events in EMEA. So welcome. See you in Istanbul and enjoy the podcast. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave.
We're in the beautiful, cold city of Helsinki. You've been here for a good couple hours, and we're going to kick off this podcast right by me reading your quote to you. And this is my second time trying this because you wrote in the Queen's English, which is always challenging. So John Wright, quoting him, you, "We want to build a place where developers can frequent," which in English, in the proper English, means meet
and discuss. Come often, yeah.
And come often. So for all the Americans, where developers can frequent, where there's information on everything, not just around us, but also advising them on what to do to be successful if they were going to self-publish. We want to coach developers. We want to be the nice guy.
Yeah.
Are you competing with Deconstructor of Fun? What is this? What is this mission statement?
No, this is just something that I come up with, and I think it goes in line with what the mission statement of Quali is, which is making the funnest games for the world to play us.
Yes.
Right? So I think a big part of us is, even though we're a publisher, we come from an internal development background, right? And the idea is that publishers can be quite ruthless. And, you know, there is a lot of people out there that make amazing games that will never see daylight, right? And it's not because that the development is bad. It's just because an amount of metrics have been predefined by senior people in a room who have then said, okay, if this doesn't hit that, we're not willing to go in.
Never been in those meetings. And actually, I left a strategic part out of your quote. It says, "We want to be the nice guy of publishing." Otherwise, this could have been all about DOF, but you're the nice guys of publishing. So today, it's great to have you here. We know, of course, from the past, met multiple times in the beautiful trips to in the Game Fest.
We also did an event here together once, if you remember.
We did
an event in Helsinki.
We did a product event in Helsinki.
This was years ago.
That's true. Second time in Helsinki.
Yeah.
So actually, John, before we move forward, who are you and what is Quali?
Sure. I mean, that's a very sort of
existential question.
How long have I got? Are you going to time me? Have I got 2 minutes or 10?
Let me center this in or laser this in. So, John, your background is in finance, and that makes you pretty good with math.
I would hope so, yes.
And you also like games.
Love games.
And then math plus games equals either product management or user acquisition.
Pretty much.
And you're not product management.
Not now.
Okay, so you went into user acquisition.
Yep.
And then you've had your career. I only remember your career from Iron Source.
Yep.
Then you went to Luna Labs.
Yep.
Then Luna Labs got acquired by Iron Source.
Correct.
And then Iron Source got acquired by Unity.
Correct.
And then Quali did not get acquired by Unity.
Not yet.
So you're for the first time kind of like out of Iron Source.
In the last 8 years, it's the
Unity.
First time. Yeah.
So that is your career. And since then, you've been mainly on the sort of a vendor side in the user acquisition.
Yep.
So Luna Labs focusing on playable ads and making playable ads really easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps with the hyper-casual side of business.
Yep.
Iron Source, of course, is a big ad tech company known for many things.
too many other things. How come I don't remember what everything Iron Source is known for? But all the ad monetization that goes into the video ads, it's known for that. It's known for as being a hyper-casual publisher. Yep. And of course, that's the connection between the Luna Labs and Iron Source at being one of the biggest hyper-casual, if not the biggest hyper-casual publishers, having all the tools and tips. And by having all those things, by doing them internally, being able to also publish others' games and help them to publish them. And then you move from Iron Source to Quali, which is in kind of a similar position where that company started off as a hyper-casual publisher by some old-school, hardcore game developers.
Yep.
I remember because I've actually interviewed them for a podcast a long, long time ago and met the founders and so forth. I remember the game Plank. I'm blanking on everything else. And since then, Quali has also evolved. It has grown quite significantly. It grew first as a very successful hyper-casual publisher to now going more into casual, going into PC. I remember there was a PC game. There was like some shooter game published. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's going on with Quali now. It's a lot in the news through the games that it has been publishing, through the partnership that is working. It's working with multiple different companies. And of course, since you joined, you've been also doing the media tours. And now you're at the pinnacle of your media tour, which is Deconstructor. Can't even say that with a straight face.
I'm actually in Forbes tomorrow as well, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So almost at the tip of the spear. So what didn't get? Is that like a...
I mean, wow, like a, you know, I mean, I feel like you just interviewed me for me. Like, no, like, I mean, I think you touched on all the major things, dude. Like, again, if we start off with my background, so, again, I started off in accountancy, actually. So I studied, you know, something called an AAT, Association of Accounting Technician Diploma. I then went into work at WPP, which is one of the biggest sort of companies in the UK. It's 150,000 people. It's a conglomerate of 150-something different companies. And
sounds fun.
It wasn't. I mean, it was my first experience in the big corporate world, right? And, you know, there's certain people that culturally align with being part of blue chip corporate worlds, and there's certain people that don't. And for me, as this young guy from East London who is like a diehard sort of gamer, little bit geeky,
like Tottenham.
I'm a West Ham fan, actually.
Okay, I just threw it out there because I was thinking about it.
But essentially, I went into the corporate world expecting. Well, if anything, I'd say I did it because, you know, where I grew up was a very poor background. Mm-hmm. My parents both very, like, working class. You know, my mum was a hospice nurse. My dad was a builder. And, you know, as all people do want for their children is they want them to be better, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from a schooling perspective, from an education perspective, from a work perspective, they were always pushing me to do better, right? To go that one step further, which I think everyone, again, who's a parent can relate to.
Yes.
The problem was that I was probably like, you know, was it a square peg in a circle hole, right? And even though I did really well in the accountancy thing and I got good grades and I went on to work at one of the biggest companies in the UK, there was something that just was just not categorically, just wasn't right. And I think this is also the... later in my career, this is where the power of culture comes in and actually understanding the people that you work with, because, you know, you need to build an environment where everyone is accepted. And very sadly, for some of these bigger sort of corporate companies, it's like if you're different or sound different or you think different in a certain way, then, you know, you're not going to have the career that you thought. But, you know, again, it was a great experience for me. I learned a lot, you know, I had great exposure to very smart people, which was great. But eventually, after a couple of years of doing that, I realized that, you know, this wasn't what I wanted to be. This wasn't who I was. And, you know, you end up trying to change the way you are, the way you talk, the way you act to basically, you know,
fit in.
Yeah, to fit in.
Yeah.
And actually, man, anyone who tells you that's the right thing to do with your life is categorically wrong. And, you know, you need to be yourself. And that's how you get your best work done. And, You know,
I'll give a caveat to that. Unless they pay you a boatload, then do whatever they say.
If they're gonna get me a yacht, then I'll do. Yeah, I'll be who they want to be.
Let's be realistic over here. yes.
But this was. I mean, part of it was this entire thing. It was the fact that money was driving me rather than passion.
Yes.
Right. And this is why you get into these companies. I don't think many people get into these companies who are passionate about, you know, big corporate. You know, conglomerate world, you know, it's all about bottom line, it's all about beta, like it's about money.
It's the same thing as people choose certain game companies. It's their prestige and being able to say in the pub that I work for this company, and being, or not in the pub, in the whatever the public discourse. See, now you got me saying all these English words like the pub, but whatever GDC or something you are, it's much nicer to say you work at Supercell or you work for Xbox, or, you know, all these sort of prestige organizations. But, you know, things come with them as that they are quite uniform and they're our spokesperson. And that's just a part of being any corporation. Mm-hmm. They have to be very clear on how they communicate and how they present themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's why they limit the amount of voices that can speak. It's just normal. Yep. It's part of the job. There's nothing bad in that. There's nothing inherently evil in that. It's just the way corporations work.
Yeah, exactly. And, dude, look, I wouldn't change... like that part of my background for anything, right? Yeah. Like it actually, I think it's something that I heard you say once, actually, was like, you know, like to know what a good boss is, you need to know what a bad boss was, you know? Like you need to have good and bad experiences to basically know what kind of leader you want to be, right?
Yeah, so, and I've actually evolved in that point as more as like, there are good and bad bosses for sure, but then there are your... like somebody, well, let's put it this way. I've had people who I would consider are bad bosses for me, but then they have been good bosses for others.
Yep.
And they have actually enjoyed working in those. And I never went to saying like, those are bad people or bad bosses, because I'm like, no, it's just not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
Do you think saying these English sayings just rubs off. Like we shouldn't have talked for an hour before this.
But the thing is, I think you've got a point there, but I think it also depends if you've got a fixed management style.
Yeah.
Whereas I think like the best leaders I've ever worked with actually push the individuals they work with in different ways, knowing that, you know, what the best is for them. So know your people, know their strengths and weaknesses, and then tailor your management style to get the most out of them.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you're very fixed in your ways, and I also think this comes with a more junior management style. Like I think the older you get, the more people you manage, the more you realize that you have to be a bit agile when it comes down to ultimately you still have to set goals and you have to lead by outcomes and you have to or do all of these things. But, you know, there's also a case of you also have to be flexible enough to basically get the most out of the team, because, you know, if you don't bend, you break, right? Yeah. So
yeah, I don't know what to answer to that. I've been like watching too much, like we're steering way too far, but I've been watching these documentaries with the football teams and the managers and whatnot. Yeah. And like with under somebody, they play really well, under somebody else, they don't play really well, but the others play really well under one. So I think it's just a game of mix and match.
Yeah.
And I would say that a lot of, especially leaders that I've worked with under who are more experienced, they definitely have more breadth of leadership style, but they still have their leadership style.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not, you know, if that's not your leadership style, then you're just a wrong player in this team. Doesn't make you a bad player, but it's not fit. And you could bitch and moan about that leader, but in the end, it's just like, it's their leadership style. And so, pick another team.
Yeah. And do you know what, dude? I agree with you in the sense of, I think it's much easier to build a team and select the players that you want right from the beginning rather than inheriting one later, because then you have to adapt and change and stuff like that. So,
but let's talk.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
Hey game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Exola's got your back with Exola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Exola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Exola's PayStation in action? Visit exola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description.
Let's talk about strategically quality. So in an interview, Mobile Gamer Biz, shout out to Mobile Gamer Biz, you presented a three-point plan to grow the mobile business of Quali. It has also PC business as well.
Correct.
On Steam. And you mentioned three strategic pillars. Number one, build out the existing publishing platform. Number two, seek right games to publish. And number three, invest into teams. So let's break these down. What is Quali's existing publishing platform and how does it need to be improved? Because it seems pretty good. Like you have, what, 1 billion installs?
Over, yeah. Probably 1.2, 1.3.
Why fix if it ain't broken?
So I think the issue with the current portal or platform, whatever you want to call it, is that the functionality and the upkeep were not good enough for where the market is going. I think there are much stronger players in the market. If you want to look at some great tech, look at things what Homer are doing right now, right? I think they've been very much focused on the technology rather than maybe the, how do I say that?
Content?
Yeah, the content itself. But from our perspective, like I said, we obviously built a place where people can come and submit games for testing, right? But that was the be-all and end-all. Like, you then try and expand, you then try and add additional content, you try to add things like, videos based on certain things that the developer you think would find interesting. Maybe, some input on creative management or like how to do iterations or, how to actually look at churn analysis on a level basis. So you can start putting some of that really like those cliff note things in there. But the portal, if it's not the upkeep, if it is not regular, then eventually it doesn't have the pull to bring people back time and time again. And if you think of this, if we were looking at this as a SaaS business, right, and this is where my experience from Lunar Labs comes in, you're looking at adoption, right? So effectively, the developers are our clients. And the way you look as a SaaS company, you would look at the adoption of the individuals. So you would say, okay, how many people are coming back? How often? How long is the session time and length? And what areas of the platform are they integrating and using the most? So for us to actually evolve what we have to look at all of that information and start providing things that are going to become useful, but the upkeep very, very, is the ability for people to come back time and time again is there.
So in practice terms, like if I'm a publisher, let's say I have my 5-man team, we make dope hyper-casual games, I want to interact with your platform. Mm-hmm. What is it? Like, is it like a... Like,
so
what am I seeing? What am I experiencing?
Yeah, so what it is now is like a very basic environment where you can go on, submit some games, and then that would be linked to, a testing protocol. So basically, you would upload a few videos, you would enter some details, the link to the game, and then this would, basically for an API, get uploaded as a campaign onto Facebook, and then, we would do some testing, and, we would then evaluate the early stage performance. And I think the big difference and one of the big changes in the current landscape of publishing is, or at least with hyper-casual moving to hybrid and further to casual, like things like CPI tests are sort of no longer relevant, dude. They're like, you can do CPI tests, but quite frankly, you could get an IPM of 40 or 50 and you could still not potentially have like a successful game. Whereas a couple of years ago, you know, you could, with a 40 IPM, you could scale that to the top of the charts, because you knew that even if your ARPU was 30 cents, 40 cents, 50 cents, because the IPM was so strong, the marketability was there to carry the game, even though the profitability wasn't. So in the last year or two, this is why hybrid has evolved, right? This is why things have happened, because we know that we need the depth of game to be able to compensate for the higher CPIs, which have been driven by high eCPMs, which have been driven by IDFA deprecation and privacy.
Okay, so, let me break that down. So marketability is not that relevant anymore because eCPMs have gone up.
Correct.
And eCPMs have gone up because in order to get your CPI, I would have to divide the amount IPM would be like installs per 1,000 impressions and then...
Divide a CPM divided by CPM. Yeah.
So I would divide IPM by CPM, right?
Yeah, to get CPI. Give you CPI, yeah. CPI times IPM equals eCPM.
Got it. So 1,000 impressions, how many of those 1,000 impressions got installed? That's divided, none. Yep. And that's how you get the CPI. And then eCPM is the one that divides.
Yeah, exactly. But again, eCPM is how much money per 1,000 impressions the publisher's getting paid for the inventory, right? Yeah. And what's also happened is, with the market has changed, and I mean, you do enough analysis to know this, but there's not as many new games going into the top of the charts than there was 2 years ago. So what happens when supply goes down? You know, gets more expensive. So
the demand.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing. The demand, as if anything, I'd say, is as aggressive as it was 2 years ago. But the supply just isn't there in the quantity it was. So things have gone back. And by the way, dude, the eCPMs we're seeing now are the same, in my opinion, as what were before hyper-casual ever happened. Like, if we go back 7, 8, 9 years ago, I think, you know, the $40 iOS US CPMs that I'm seeing now are exactly what I was doing and looking at when we were looking at for things like for King, you know, and the big companies back then. So, you know, I feel like the market somewhat, you know, went on a tangent and it evolved for hyper-casual, and it found this, you know, this, you know, cash machine to earn loads of money very quickly. And now, you know, the market has evolved again and things are going back to focusing on the actual... It's more than just, you know, a marketable core mechanic. You know, you do need depth of game. You need to have day 30, day 90 and everything else. So
business model has changed because the business model was very attached to marketability. And now it's been going back towards the basic stuff that was there before.
Yeah.
See, we don't even bother when somebody comes in and gets out. We're just professionals. Got it. So eCPMs are getting higher. That's clear. And the improvements to the platform, meaning like it has to cater to more than just testing marketability, because marketability is not important anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, just to correct you slightly, I wouldn't say it's not important. I'd say it's not a defining factor anymore.
It's not the important.
The most important.
The most important. I was trying to use the wrong word, importantness.
but yeah, so like that's basically it. And I think from a platform perspective, you know, you need to offer a lot more, right? Yeah. And you have to be a lot more transparent. So, you know, things like we will be adding will be like A/B testing functionality, right? Like it will be how to actually look at changes in gameplay and what the outcomes will be, right? And it will also be having a true sort of educational part where, you know, content is being updated on a weekly basis. And this goes back to the bigger plan, which is, you know, Quali is trying to be wants to be the nice guy. We're also aware that studios work with publishers for out of necessity.
Yeah.
And, you know, if a lot of studios would prefer to self-publish if they could, but the problem is a lot of these companies don't have the skills, the money, or the expertise, you know, that you need. And, you know, in the hyper-casual days, people cracked the code, you know? And that's why so many companies were doing it. Whereas if you look at the top 100 now, the same names who were doing this 2 years ago are not there, dude, you know? Yeah. And so it's, the market is consolidating in the sense of the big publishers, the people like Quali, Homer, Voodoo, etc. These are the ones that are becoming ever more dominant again, because the advantage for the small guy has been taken away.
Yeah.
And this is why, again, from our perspective, there's two ways you can approach this. Either you can be aggressive and you know, it's a buyer's market and use that to your advantage, or you can stay true to your values as a company and say, actually, we just want to launch really cool games with people that we like.
Got it. So, okay, building out existing platform because it was skewed very heavily towards hyper-casual and through that putting marketability above everything else. And now it's just adding more functionality so you can properly test your game, focusing more on retention metrics probably.
Exactly.
Rather than just purely on...
So when we do testing now, again, like a year and a half, 2 years ago, you would build... I wouldn't even call it an MVP.
Yeah.
I'd call it a scene in Unity, right? Mm-hmm. Like you would have enough footage for a level or maybe up to 10 levels, right? So, you know, this sort of like 10-minute experience was already built in, you know, not even put into an app form yet, just something that you can record a screen grab from. And then you were taking that to Facebook. You were testing, you know, a couple of different sort of like video iterations of the same gameplay. You were looking at marketability and then saying, okay, this game's marketable, we'll take it to retention. Now, we're actually doing the retention day one test and the marketability test at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So the MVP itself has gone from being like 5 to 10 minutes of gameplay to being at least an hour, because we need to ensure that, you know, like at least a day one session of at least 60 minutes to make sure that someone comes back the next day, right?
Because
if you're capped out, and we know that average session times are 20, 30, 40 minutes, so you need to make sure you're covering that.
That's interesting. We're kind of like taking the steps back in the evolution of the mobile gaming industry, because today I watched the talk of Adam Telfer. Shout out to Adam. Powerful Adam Telfer. His talk on GDC about I don't even know what it was about. It was about retention, really. It was about long-term retention, but he was talking about new game development. And in that talk, he said what they learned back then. He was at Wooga, so that talk was from like 2014.
Mm-hmm.
He said that they have to put out the game. Like the first version of the game is 1 month long.
Yeah.
And only then they realize not only the what are the pitfalls they have in the core gameplay, but also how they do the meta, are they able to publish it, and so forth and so forth. So really like focusing on like, can we actually make this into a successful game? And so the first version is 1 month.
Mm.
That's crazy. Are we going towards that? Because you went from 10 minutes to 1 hour. That's a big jump.
Look, in terms of incrementality, it's a big jump, right?
Yeah.
But I think if we look at, I mean, Wooga with their particular games, I mean, I think, was it June's Journey just did a billion in revenue, right?
Yeah. So he was talking about June's Journey.
So like for me, that is very much the Supercell plan, right? It's you're building, if it doesn't make a billion, you know, it's not worth your time.
Yeah.
So I think there is a place for that, right? And I think what Adam said around, you know, it is true in terms of longer content is a necessity now, not a requirement, you know, that if you want to be successful, you need to ensure that the game has the ability to last for, you know, hyper casual was 7 days. Now I would say that I wouldn't put a game to market where the, you know, the LTV curve would be less than 30 to 90 days, right? So again, if we're talking about the jumps from 7 days to 30 days to 90 days, you know, these are big sort of landslides though. But again, I feel like me and you and people of a certain experience and age, this is what it was, you know, 7-8 years ago.
Yes.
You know, you were designing stuff like day 90, day 180. God, I remember working on Zynga Poker, you know, when I was at Iron Source, and the guys had day 700.
Because that
was,
that was when
things got paid back.
Yeah.
Because the investments were so high, right? These were the days of $25 CPIs to get the right users and
machine zones, 120 and so forth.
Yeah, exactly, you know, like, and I'm not saying we're going to go back to this level because, you know, like, I think that was just wild. Like, that was a completely crazy time bidding $100 on a user, not knowing that, or knowing only one in 100 would actually end up making the money back as the other ones, right? So, but in essence, people need to develop games with more content, with deeper meta, and the ability for a user to come back time and time again in any way or means, like live ops, events, like all of this stuff, which again was massive in the past, is now becoming even more prevalent now.
This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor of Fun really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing the full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI, so what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
Preach. All right, so that's the platform stuff. Then let's go to seeking the right games. And by the way, I just want to go hyper-casual, just to make sure. Hyper-casual died because the eCPMs went up, so it was more expensive to market them.
Yeah, sure.
And because of that, because they had such a small margin, it became impossible to get your money back because the users didn't stay in those games. So you wouldn't get your money back from the ads. And so that business model evolved to hybrid casual, where you still try to bank on the high marketability, but you are trying to increase your monetization by having longer retention and by having microtransactions or in-app purchases to balance out the in-app ad revenue.
Completely. Yeah, exactly. Well said. Again, it's just an economic conversation, right? Yeah. It's a case of if the eCPMs double, then the CPI doubles. Yeah. And if your ARPU stays at the same level, you've gone from being marginally positive to being grossly negative.
Yes.
So it's literally a mathematical calculation. And that was hyper-casual for you, you know? Like, it was literally, that was it. If you could balance the scales... Yeah. Then it was successful and you launched games, right?
Yeah.
And you knew that eventually your absolute profit, because of the scale, right? So even if you're making 10 cents, when you've got tens of millions of players, you're making big money,
yes.
Right? And that was the whole calculation, dude. And the issue is that all of these changes over the last 2 years flipped the scales.
Yeah.
And now it's forced companies to evolve dramatically in terms of actually doubling down on game development. People are not doing prototypes every week anymore. People are having to spend 6 months developing a game, right? And again, that's another way that the industry sort of gone back to, you know, flipped on its head again, you know, back to how it was.
All right, let's move forward. Seek right games to publish. How do you find the right games? You mentioned the word necessity, and you said that the game developers only work with publishers out of necessity, and I reckon there's a lot of necessity going around.
I think, look, let's be very honest.
I said the word reckon.
It's going to be the reckoning.
No, it's like, keep using these English words.
Yeah, I love it. You've just been exposed to me for an hour, and your dialect's completely changed from Americanisms to British.
I lived in Manchester for a while, just a short while. It's a secret.
I don't imagine you, like, that is not the place I would put you. You know?
You're right, mate. Anyway, let's move forward. So necessity.
So look, let's be honest. The current ecosystem, the current market, you know, depending on who you ask, but in my opinion, is not in a good state.
Yeah.
We know that from an economical perspective, the, you know, the globe is fucking, you know, it's like shit on fire,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, in a paper bag on someone's doorstep, namely mine and yours.
It's a well put.
You know? And, you know, everyone is like clawing to stay afloat, dude, you know? Like, and I think I've had conversations in the last 2 months. I've been on the phone every day with developers of all shapes and sizes. And some of these people are people that I've known and worked with for 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, and some of these companies that, you know, were good, you know, they had games coming in, the cash flow was solid, they maybe did a seed raise or an A and got like a couple of $1 million, and they had runway for 2 years. Now they've got runway for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you and I both know when it starts getting your runway only lasts for 6 months. That's when you're in an element of desperate, you know, you're in a desperate place.
That's when you're staring at the barrel of the gun 6 months. Like nine is like, it's touch and go.
So I think there's a lot of, and to be honest with you, I think we've seen a lot of studios that have gone under of late, right?
Yes.
Like me and you both know people that have been affected by this, which is very sad. And again, it's one of the missions from Qualy is to try and support a lot of these people where possible. Obviously, at the end of the day, we are a business,
yeah.
right? And we're not going to throw money away for nothing. There has to be a profitability and there has to be mutual gain, right, for this to work. But the fact is there is a hell of a lot of opportunity out there, which, you know, again, in the last 2 years, I think publishers had less opportunity because people doing, you know, dev like self-publishing.
Yeah.
And now, you know, the amount of games and the type of games, and this is why we've redefined like ourselves in terms of going back to some of our heritage. And I think you spoke about this earlier, but David Darling, who's our CEO, he was the founder of Codemasters, right? And eventually that sold to EA for over $1 billion. Yeah. And he worked on Micro Machines and Colin McRae Dirt Rally and Jonah Loma Rugby. And like, you know, like these games that for a lot of us, I mean, for me and you of our generation, yeah. probably very like iconic, right?
Yeah.
Like you played those games, you grew up with those games. And I think, you know, David's, you know, sort of mission to me is like take more risks because we're in a, because of his financial status and the fact we're privately funded and, you know, all of that, it gives us a lot of flexibility to be able to take a few more risks. And actually, there's a lot of games out there, dude, that at the early stage won't hit the metrics. But if you give them, you know, a bit more time,
mm-hmm.
a bit more support, a bit more stability, a bit more focus, a bit more expertise, then these games can be very, very successful games.
That's a very interesting point that you're making, and that's why I'm asking the question is like, how do you seek the right games? Because, as you said, there's a lot of games that even when you look at their numbers early on, they look like they're dead in the water,
mm-hmm.
and over time they become major top-grossing games. I would mention too, Top Drives by Hutch.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I believe the early numbers were atrocious, and even when it was doing pretty well, the early retention rate was horrendous
mm-hmm.
compared to their other car games. But when you look at the overall curve, it's the beginning that looks really bad, but then it stays stable.
Mm-hmm.
And so the long-term retention is excellent, and that's why they're doing so great.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another game that is also, I think they're, you know, crossed, getting closer to 1 billion is probably War Robots.
Mm-hmm.
That also had an absolutely horrendous early retention rates, and they were able to figure out kind of like who's the audience and start pinpointing the marketing more towards that, and, you know, eventually launched the game and made a gazillion dollars. Mm-hmm. And so my question is like, when you're a publisher and you get a lot of games thrown towards you, it would be very easy to say like, well, 40-20-10 is kind of like the retentions we're looking mm-hmm. at and this and that. You can come up with ROAS numbers. Mm-hmm. You can come up with different things. But in my experience, a lot of these games that we know now are as very successful started from a point where this was the thing. Like, it's this or die. And then they mm-hmm. just work them to have those long-term retention numbers to, you know, they were forced to launch these games and then they made them work.
Yep.
And so how do you find the diamonds in the rough, or do you just have the sort of a very clear approach of like, these are the things that we're looking at. There's some leeways, like some of the numbers don't have to be green. They could be yellow.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to work for them for a little bit. And if we can't turn them into green, we're going to move on.
Yeah. So I think what you've said there is very accurate in the sense of, it's not like, it's not a fixed number.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not, like I said, everyone, and you were right, by the way, like day one, 40% is the target, right? Yeah. But we also know there's bands to this stuff, right? And it also depends on the amount of time that's been invested into the project. So for example, like if we're testing a new game off the bat, that again, in MVP or alpha being say 4 hours of content rather than 60 minutes. So in between that phase, there's a lot of changes to the game development, right? There's a lot of different tests that need to be done from the gameplay perspective, not a lot, you know, excluding everything we would do on Facebook and Unity. So it's about understanding at what stage of that, you know, the game is at when you're testing it, and understanding if it's in an allowable band. By band, I mean it could be, you know, 32 to 40%. Because you know this is only the first test you've done. And this actually is another interesting point about the change from hypercasual. When people used to spend money on tests, right, it used to spend like a couple hundred dollars. Now, for us to test the game, it's gone from like $300 to minimum sort of $10,000 to $15,000. Because the number of tests that you have to do are much, much more rigorous, right? Because, again, you can do an early stage test on Facebook, but you're looking at day one, so you have to be live for a week or two. You have to wait for the cohorts to mature, right? So you're spending, you know, $300-$400 per day per OS, right? So let's say $1,000 make it easy. You're live for two weeks, that's you know, 14K. And at that point, you'll have a good understanding of your day one, but also your day three and day seven, depending on, like, obviously where you are in that like alpha build, right? If you've got enough content for people to come back for day three at 4 hours, maybe. But yeah, you have to continue to test multiple times after different sprints. And I think, you know, from our perspective, again, we work on a two-week sprint model, right? Same as most tech companies, but I don't feel like in hypercasual it was like that.
Yeah.
You know, like it was very much like, again, do this, if it works, doesn't, then they're not. But to go back to the question, again, it's not about just having a fixed number, it's about having some flexibility in that. It's about understanding where the project is in that roadmap, right?
Yeah.
And if it's at the beginning of the alpha or the end of the alpha or going into like a soft launch ready state, right? But all of this depends on the number of hours content in the game. And also when the meta gets integrated as well, because, you know, we'll look at the, you know, the retention early on, day one, day three. But then ultimately you need to get the monetization in as soon as you feel like that is going to be doable, because you know, once you start adding RV, interstitial, all of this stuff, you know your retention is going to come down, right? Which is why a lot of the time, for example, even though there's a band, if it's at the low end of the band, you know, unless something categoric changes, you know, in that next build, you know, it's not going to work. And at that point, at the monetization stage, this is where things die.
And so you're primarily looking at hybrid casual games, or games that can be turned into hybrid casual.
So I think from a strategic perspective, there's two ways to look at this. One is you're going to go after your safe bets.
No.
And I think hybrid casual is your safe bets right now. And this is why, you look at all of the other big publishers in our area. And I'm not talking your Scopely's and stuff like this, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the ones that are similar to Quietly.
Yeah.
All of them are doubling down on hybrid casual. Like I said, look at everything that Voodoo's putting out, Home is putting out, Supersonic's putting out. Everything's hybrid. So this is kind of like the red ocean approach, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, so like everyone out there is trying to do this because they know it's a safe bet, because, you know, the marketability is strong because it's an evolution of hyper to hybrid. And they also know that, again, the metrics on the gameplay side, you know, session lengths are up, so retention's up, so, you know, monetization's up. So this is the safe bet, and this is where people are trying to find that new hyper casual. But the problem with that is, dude, there's a wealth of games out there that are just not that way designed.
Yeah.
And you can't just put all your eggs in the basket because it's hybrid, because you think that's going to have the highest level of conversion for your success. That is a banker's way at looking at a calculation. There is no... The way I think, again, gaming is a passion, right? It's something that you get into because you love. So you also need to ensure that you're open to other types of games, other genres, other types of teams. Like, I mean, you're an investor. How many times have you met a team, right, and instantly you knew that the team was going to be successful, even though the game might not be? So, yeah, there's a lot of people out there that maybe are not getting the love they deserve, which is, in my opinion, is the blue ocean.
Yeah.
These are the different genres of games, and these are the ones that are going to be harder to get to market. But I think if you're successful there, they're going to be the ones that surprise you the most in terms of, you know, pure revenue generation wise.
It's trying to diversify in that sense. And then the third part you mentioned is the investment part, so investing into the team. So so talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so again, I feel like right now, there, you know, everyone's aware of the current sort of VC landscape and you know, the coffers.
Everybody's not aware. I still get like...
Wait, you still, really? You get people say like, oh, you know, we're going to raise money?
Yeah.
I mean, some people are fucking idiots.
Even, well... You're talking about my friends.
Okay, so I apologize to your friends, but like
who are active listeners of our podcast as well. I was like, okay. I was like, because I'm like, don't do it. Like, now you don't start your company.
Yeah, I mean, we had this conversation, me and you privately, a couple of weeks back, right? Like, when I was talking about, you know, after the exit at uni and like, you know, getting the big day, the payday from selling Luna, you know, I had a conversation with myself, and I spoke to a few people like you and a few other friends who have done the whole startup thing. And, you know, I made a decision, which was I didn't want to do a startup. And this is ultimately why I joined Qualy, because of my history with the company. And, you know, I've known them for nearly 10 years and I love what they do and all that stuff. But timing is everything, right? And for me, it was a case of it would be crazy to start a company now and invest six-figure sums of my own money and not be able to match it with a VC round, you know? So that was, I mean, that was a conversation I had with myself, dude, you know?
Yeah, mature conversation, I would say. More mature than many do.
But this is the thing. So, you know, VCs, again, base their calculations on certain metrics, and the idea is that they need to earn, a 10 or 20 multiplier on their investment, right? Probably 20, or closer to 20. And, you know, when there was a lot of acquisitions in the market and you know, money was more accessible.
I remember those times.
You remember those times? Good times, man. Good times. There's hope they come back sometime soon. I'm really hoping for the good days to
be capitalize on those times. That's what you do.
So, and this is the thing. So this is goes back to, you know, Qualy strategy and the third prong, which is, you know, I called it diamond mining, because I feel like for us right now, like, we, as a privately funded business with someone as successful as David Darling and someone who, you know, has been in gaming for 35 years and has seen the evolution from, you know, the early, early days to now, he understands that there's waves and cycles to everything. And he knows that, you know, in the next couple of years, the VC landscape will get back to where it is. You know, I mean, Crest says this all the time, right? It's peaks and troughs. Crest says a lot of things. You know? No, but I agree with him. Like, it's peaks and troughs, right, when it comes down to anything to do with, you know, the economy or finance in general. And right now, we're at a low point, right?
Bear.
Yeah, it's a bear market. And adversity breeds opportunity, right? And for us... Like, I mean, well, for certain people it does, okay? Like, not
sounds
for
like an American saying. Always hopeful.
Yeah. You quote John, that's a John White original, okay?
It doesn't sound like an English saying, to be honest.
Thanks for that. But no, it does. Like, I mean, and sadly, it's the opportunity for the big guy, right? And it's the ones who have the money. And this is where you'll find people, you know, in maybe not in our shoes or in different shoes, but there'll be people out there with money who can invest a lot less now and get a lot more than they could have a couple of years ago when the market was more fruitful.
Yes.
And, you know, from our perspective, you know, again, Qualy does have certain amount of funds that we will do in terms of equity investments into businesses.
Got it. Let me ask this in very like a very exemplary term. Let's say there's a game studio. They are making games out of Montpellier in south of France.
Mm-hmm.
Good location. Nice place to travel. Actually, I don't know. I've never been there. But looks like a nice location.
Looks nice. I've seen a postcard once.
So, I digress. They're making fun games. Small company. Hyper casuals. You come in. Not you come in. They come to you.
Mm-hmm.
They listen to this interview. And it's like, John... Very much. I don't think I'm gonna do French accent. Very much like
edit,
your
edit.
We very much like your beautiful French accent. We very much like your model. Qualy sounds very interesting. We like that you're independent. We don't want to work with other French hyper casual publishers. we have this game. They go through your platform. It looks like a good game. There's a lot of traction there. They optimize a little bit. Everything keeps going better. The team is very agile. They complete their sprints and the two-week sprints efficiently. Keep improving, keep adding all the SDKs. Everything is working great. It looks like this could be a game that if you would put in additional 6 to 9 months building proper meta, because these fellas have not built metas before, but you could say, hey, this with that is diamond. What is the investment like? What happens after that?
So there's two ways to look at it. One is like purely dev funding, right? So traditional dev funding, i.e. you understand the operating expense of the title or the studio, right? And then the idea is that you will fund a certain amount of roadway for that game to be produced, right? Okay. So you do, you would look at a milestones sort of breakdown. You would say, okay, it's going to take 2 months for MVP, 2 months for soft launch, or 2 months at alpha, 4 months at soft launch, and then, you know, in 8 months you've got a hard launchable game. So obviously there's different ways to break it down, but the idea is you would want to sustain the studio for that amount of time to ensure that your investment's going to pay out, right? Because what you can't do is be too cheap. And then after 4 months, the studio's like, well, look, sadly, we've run out of money, right? So you need to be to assure that the financial investment is large enough to sustain the studio or the team involved in
it. So let me just do like milestones. All right, now you've signed a contract with them that they're working only for you with this thing. And you were going to fund them for, let's say, maximum 6 months from now. You agree on the milestones. You agree on the cost of everything. They're happy with it. You're happy with it. What else? What's next? Now, 6 months later, they've completed everything you've said. And it's looking even better. What are we doing then?
Well, hopefully we've got everything, all of our ducks in a row to sort of hard launch the game, right? So during this whole time, you would have done, again, rigorous testing across all of the platforms, right? You had done Facebook, Unity, AppLovin, all of the big names. You would understand the full potential of a couple of different markets. So probably all of your tier ones, and you would start be testing localization at that point. And the idea being that as long as the metrics are holding, right, you start scaling and watching the CPI. So the idea being that the more scale you require, the more expensive it becomes. So this is like the whole balancing. And I think this is something that's very interesting for me at the moment, dude. We're launching a game, and we're Qualia launching sort of, I think we've got 3 games in launch at the moment. And the launch strategy of yesteryear was like, you went really big, and then the CPIs eventually sort of went down slightly because of creative optimization. And then even if you made a loss in your first week or two, eventually the long tail would back out, and you were forcing the game to the top of the market, and then the K factor, the organics, all of that stuff would keep it there, right? And this would mean that your effective CPI would go down because of the organic users that were associated to the investment. Now what we're seeing is that because of the change in the Apple Store and, you know, the reconfiguration, and I mean, Neil Long spoke a lot about this, and so you know what's happening now is that the launch strategies are much sort of longer and more steady.
Got it.
So you're not forcing
gradual
exactly. So the idea is that you go to market and you launch on different platforms, different countries, etc., and you steadily see how much you can spend at the right level of profitability. And so you predefine, you know, what a goal is. And that could be like 10% profit, 20% profit. But ultimately, the publishing deal also is a profit share, right? So the more profitable the game and the more the scale you can get, the more money the developer also earns and more money you earn, right? So this is why it's much more calculative in that way. It's more gradual over time now.
So let me be clear what I'm asking then. I understand the dev funding part. And then I understand very much how you get to a hard launch. But once you cross that line of a hard launch, that means the team is now starting, well, at some point is starting to make money. So there's an investment phase now until they get to the right type of a scale. You're watching the CPIs, et cetera, et cetera. You're gradually growing it. You're improving the game. Everybody's excited. This game is live. It's bringing in money. Everybody can see the revenue, and the revenue is increasing every week. Everybody's happy, but the team would not be happy depending on their contract. And I've never seen a publishing contract that makes the team happy?
Look, I think ultimately the publishing business is one of high risk.
Yeah.
And for every developer success, there's dozens of games that didn't work, right?
Of course.
And it's, from our perspective, it's about trying to be fair whilst also being balanced in the sense of ensuring that our business is sustained and we're able to make a profit. And again, whilst, you know, I want to invest in as many gaming companies as possible, this is still a business, right? Yeah. It's the business of fun, but it's a business.
Yes.
So ultimately, there has to be some offset from that. But I think also the thing is that it also depends on the negotiation power of the studio and what we're trying to achieve. And, you know, for us, there are things like, you know, milestone rewards, which would be like, you know, the profit share might shift by a couple of points because of hitting certain markets.
Let me ask you this. Why don't you just acquire the studio?
Oh, God.
Or so, why don't you acquire the asset?
So that is a great question, and I think it's something that...
Even better, because the studio's in France, or maybe you just acquire the asset.
So, let's not talk about French law, because I've been looking into this recently, and it's a fucking minefield, okay?
So just the asset. Oops.
So like, obviously, a lot of publisher contracts will have a right to buy clause.
Yeah.
So, like, for some of our contracts, we do have that. And what that could mean is that if the game hard launches, it generates this amount of revenue that we would hold the right to actually acquire the studio for, or sorry, not the studio, the IP, the game, for an X amount pre-agreed.
Yeah.
So that could be, say, $1 million, right? Yeah. And then that $1 million then goes directly to the developer.
To the tax man.
Part of it to the tax man for them, those poor French with 45% tax. They got a terrible tax scheme.
Yeah, I know.
Okay? So these poor French guys, I feel sorry for them.
Yeah. To the king.
Yeah. But ultimately, again, then we would inherit the asset or acquire the asset, and then we would have the 100% of the profit would be ours, right? Unless there was maybe like an agreement which said like they would keep paying them a small percentage on long term.
Yeah,
like.
But I'm asking this because Quali is a development studio. Mm-hmm. Like, you make your own games.
Yes.
And so for you to acquire an asset seems very natural.
Yeah, and we've actually, I can't like openly tell you this now, but there's two games that we've signed, acquired in the last sort of 2 to 4 weeks, and our internal teams are now working on them, and it's part of our strategy. Mm. And I think there's a couple of other companies out in the market that have already isolated this, but you know, there is a lot of opportunity for games that maybe 2 years ago were very successful, or you know, hyper casual games, or games that maybe didn't live up to the full potential that can be reworked. And part of it, and this is what, you know, before we actually kicked off the meeting, so I feel like a bit like a VC at the moment, because, you know, I'm getting so many opportunities from people saying, hey, would you want to acquire this game for 50K, 100K, or would you want to invest in our studio and an equity deal and own a percentage and get a seat on the board? And, you know, I don't think publishers were getting this kind of offer 2 years ago when things were easy.
Yeah.
Right? And so for us now, like, again, from a strategic perspective, our ability to launch games and publish games is much wider, because it's not just the traditional format. You know, having, you know, doing an equity deal with a studio is something that's extremely exciting for me, because we then get an even bigger sort of finger on the pulse of what's going on, and also in terms of the actual strategic direction and just the involvement of what we do. And eventually, again, if that studio, you know, it ends up being very successful, we would always have, like, a right to buy more equity or buy the studio in completely and do the whole M&A.
Yeah.
And then that then just becomes a bigger asset of Quali, and the internal studio then evolves, and we're then making better games internally with, you know, higher levels of profitability for us, but also hopefully the people that were developing them, the founders and the team of these companies, financially were compensated as part of the M&A, but also we give them a good enough sort of, you know, compensation to keep them going for years to come.
So what do you think about Voodoo's model? So their model within hybrid casual works in a way that they have essentially two groups making games. The ones who sort of built the core game, and the ones who do the live operations. And those are different teams. And the game actually goes from building phase to operations phase, where it's fully handed off. And the way the publishing works, like the challenges with publishing, what I was trying to say is that I think always exists is that even in the best case scenario where you have that great game, that it is scaling, that the publisher is putting money to grow, the team is working on the updates and everything is hunky-dory, at some point, I've seen just the relationships cater because the developer wants a piece of the cake and the publisher is saying, there is no cake. We are spending more on here and you might get something later. And then the excitement of working on it doesn't really pan because X, Y, and Z, and they start working on another game, and all these problems I've been seeing happening in games that were even in top 50 grossing being published. And so that's why I think the model that Scopely has perfected, where they do the development contract with the studio, they work for it for a long time, and then if they pass that milestone of a global launch, then that studio is acquired. Yep. And in case of Voodoo, what happens is that they might find studio in the rough, or somebody they worked before, or somebody new, who makes a really exciting core, it passes through, they're able to, you know, get the proper numbers right. They talk to their live ops team, like, hey, what if we give you this and you build this? They're like, yeah, we like that. Get us that game and we'll take it. And they might either acquire the asset or they might acquire the entire studio. If the studio has a background that they can ship multiple of these fun games, then keep doing that in Montpellier, make those fun cores, and then once it's ready, ship it to Leamington Spa. We'll put the wheels on this and and push it down the hill.
Yeah, no, dude, like basically what you've said and you've described with Scopely is actually one of the strategies that we're also operating. I think the issue is that live ops and events and all of that stuff is actually in some way more difficult than actually developing the core game.
Yeah.
I think once you've done the ideation and you understand what the core, you know, loop is, and you know, once you've then understand, okay, the meta for this style of game should be that. Yeah. Like, there is kind of a playbook, and I think with live ops, like, in my opinion, it's not, I wouldn't say understated, but the value that it brings is tremendous.
Yes.
And look at Royal Match with the live ops they do. They have multiple events at any time with different types of currency, and it's basically making people engage with different things at all times, right? You're getting drawn back multiple times a day, 7 days a week for years to come because of how aggressive the live ops and event strategy is. I think this is a big part of where the industry will have to go and where the development will be, and also, like I said, people are going to have to get better at live ops. And I'm telling you now, studios that from the hyper casual days don't know that much about live ops. Right?
No, like, they've never done it.
It's something that bigger studios like Scopely have a lot of history in. And I think the involvement and the growth that will be needed, and the successful studios that will come out of this whole next wave of hybrid and casual, will be the ones that actually nail live ops. They'll be the ones that are really successful.
And so, do you have the capabilities internally at Leamington Spa to do live ops?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. So we have, obviously, the company's like 450 people. So we, you know, we're
it's decent. Like half of the town.
Yeah, basically. I mean, for those who don't know Leamington Spa, it's literally like a 50,000 person sort of like town, two hours outside of London.
Yeah.
But it's got a very good gaming heritage, and there's many gaming companies that are based there, and you know, it's a really good hub. Outside of London, at a slightly cheaper rate, which is good for a lot of companies. Like Sega have a massive studio there, right? Yeah. So, but that's, I think this is one of the big advantages of what Quali is and does compared to some of the other big publishers looking into this area, is because at our core, at our root, we are a studio and not a publisher.
Yes.
You know, so we're a publisher with all of the ability, experience, and skill, you know, resources of a studio. And what that also means for us is that the type of deals that we can offer and the ways that we work are similar to Scopely's in that way. And again, acquiring games or even coming up with a code dev solution, right? So what we could do is we could actually speak to the developer and say, hey, like, you are, and remember, publishing is a variety game. Like, I'm talking to people that are one person solo devs, and I'm talking to companies that are 300 people, right? And some of those smaller code, like smaller solo devs, like, the roadmap is very difficult for them to hit, because a lot of the time these guys are, maybe this is a side project, or maybe it's a full-time thing, but you know, they're one person with one set of hands. Like, you know, they can't do everything. And having the ability to code dev with them and use the resources from our internal studio and reallocate resources from that. And also in my team, the publishing team, I have engineers, I have programmers, I have game artists, I have game designers. And these people are resources that we, you know, in the publishing team can allocate based on the right opportunity. And this is where a lot of the added value, I think, comes from.
And you might say that sounds silly, but Merge Dragon was done by one person. And then Graham took it over and boom.
I mean,
$1 billion later.
Yeah, exactly, dude. And look, don't get me wrong. I know that they're rare, right? But you shouldn't discount the studio based on the number of people they have.
Yeah.
Or even, I think, too often, especially I think this is one of the things that the VCs fall short at, is they read into the background too much.
No.
You know?
Really? Yeah. No, I wouldn't know.
but look, like, some people have a pure natural born talent, and some people spend, you know, 20 years at Epic or someone else, right? And a lot of the time, you know, the VC will be like, oh, okay, because of that heritage must mean they're going to be successful.
No, it's I'm going to defend the good old VCs here a little bit.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of numbers to look at, and sometimes the pedigree is one of the few things that helps. And if the person has a certain pedigree that fits with what they're about to do, I'll give an example. Mm-hmm. Axel Byte, which is a back-end infrastructure startup.
Mm-hmm.
The founder has built backends, I think, full Epic backend, and I think EA backend. Yeah. And as that person is moving to, like, I've built these backends of these big companies, I know how to service certain studios, I know what we did right, what we did wrong, and this is the starting point where we want to be. I'm not going to quote the other founder, maybe you've talked to him, but where they want to be the sort of like the central tech for all these studios so that they don't have to go through the troubles and tribulations of building their own backends.
Mm-hmm.
I would understand that the background of coming in from Epic and EA is more credible than if they would have been from your mom and pop, you know, startup.
Yeah, yeah, okay. You're right there, right? You're right there.
And so it depends, really. But I understand what you're saying. The background, like, is not everything.
Yeah,
exactly. But if you are from Eton, likely you're do well.
That's it. Pip, pip. No, so, but that's the thing. I think a lot of the time, some of these smaller companies get discredited because, you know, they don't have that heritage and that background.
Yeah.
And again, I think from a VC's perspective, it's so calculative, you know. It's so, like, there are so many things and, like, these sort of checklists that they have to go through, and a weighting system and a scoring system
with a VC
really, right? I mean, yes, I believe so.
You know, so or believe so.
I know so.
Okay.
So of course there's, like, an internal scoring system, right? I have an internal scoring system,
and VCs have also.
I mean the ones I've spoken to, we definitely have a way to gauge the quality of the studio and the you know, things like you're saying, like the heritage of the studio is part of that, right?
I think so.
But that's the thing. So with some of the smaller guys, they get discredited because maybe they don't have this. But we all know, again, sometimes you know, a young guy with passion will be better than...
Or gal.
Or a young guy or girl, or they, will be better, you know, or develop. And also, it depends on what they're trying to develop, right? Like, if it's a small but fun game, right, maybe that's doable. But if it's, you know, the guy with heritage, as you said, is trying to build something like a huge platform, and this is like tens of millions of dollars in investment and something grand, right, then it's horses for courses, right? Like, you're going to go for the person that you need. So English saying for you.
That, horses for courses, that's the first thing, and I'm going to end this on the horses for courses. For what kind of horses is the course of Quali? Like, what are the studios you're looking for?
Yes, I think...
Because the whole conversation was, basically I was left with, you're very flexible.
Mm-hmm.
You're willing to take risks. You have a lot of resources that you could put in. They don't have to be all financial resources. You have game development resources. You are flexible on the type of contracts that you can make. You're very interested in doing something new.
Yeah.
Same but new. I would say that would be the strategy.
Yeah, I mean,
because it's kind of but we want like hybrid casual with this and that, kind of like all that same, but not same, but new,
I think it's what it is. I think what we are very fortunate enough to have in Quali is we have a couple of different bets on a couple of different things, and including the PC console stuff that you brought up earlier, yeah. Right? So we have the publishing team, we have our internal team, we have a casual team who are just working on Solitaire and games like this, which, you know, hasn't launched yet, but yeah. Things coming out there. Then we have PC console. So we have four like internal startups within the company, all focused on different areas. And luckily for me, like being in charge of the mobile publishing unit, you know, I get flexibility somewhat, and obviously it's a discussion of balance, and it's again going after something that, you know, conversion wise is going to be more likely to be successful, but it's also making sure that you're not just stuck in the red ocean all the time, and it is trying to find those new things. And just because, you know, there's more than just hybrid casual games out in the market, right? There are a wealth of different genre of games that are even, you know, being developed now, which maybe have never been there before. And it's about ensuring as a business we're not too narrow in focus to ensure that we don't lose those missed opportunities. And missed opportunities kill businesses,
yeah.
You know? And so for us, it's about making sure that, you know, going back to your question, I think a lot of the time it's understanding the vision of the team, understanding the founders, you know, their sort of ethos and morals and what they want to achieve as a business. If that then sort of interlinks with Qualy and our culture, our fit, and we see a match, and ultimately I think it goes back to what you said about Scopely and maybe seeing like an acquisition at some point, and you know that, you know, if this was to go the distance,
yeah, when the stars align,
you want to make sure that if this company was now part of Qualy, that they would be a good fit, right? And there wouldn't be that clash. So I think again, culture, vision, fit, all of that stuff is super super important to us. But I also think that we want people who are, you know, not risk averse. Like, we want people that are going to try and do something a bit different, try and like redefine something in some way,
yeah.
And not just go down the easy road. Like, we want someone who's going to try and do something that is going to be defining, you know, something that's going to be remembered.
Yeah.
Like David Darling, you know, our founder, you know, again, he's got legacy because of Codemasters and Micro Machines and all this stuff he built. You know, Jason Falkus, who's the COO, you know, was the original developer on NBA Jam. And like, we have like this really rich history, but a lot of these guys tried and tested, you know, they want to continue that legacy. And I feel like because of that, you know, that 30 odd years of experience that the founders have, that, you know, they understand how important that is.
To bring something new to the table.
Yeah, because if you've been in the gaming industry for 30 years, you've seen a lot of news, right? And anyone who, if you stay in the past, you get left behind and you die.
Yeah.
So, you know, you always have to have one foot in front.
All right. How can developers get in touch with you and your team?
I mean, all of the usual channels. You know, you can actually come through the platform and you can enter a request there.
That's probably the best way.
I wouldn't say the best way now, because we're sneak peek. We're relaunching the new platform. Mm. Is going to be launched in January. I don't know the date yet, but again, we spoke about this, but we've took the old one. We have an amazing product person that's been putting, you know, working with myself and Will Cox, who's the head of publishing, to build something that is going to, you know, create a home for developers to come to, like we said, you know, somewhere to frequent. So, you know, that would be the best place from January. But for now, LinkedIn, email, website, you know, all of the usual stuff.
Horrible amount of pitches. That's the life of a VP of publishing.
Oh, yeah, I mean, also, if you want to message me on LinkedIn, feel free. I really don't mind.
Oh, wow. All right, people. Catch John Wright on LinkedIn. Send him a video of your gameplay.
Please. It's important.
Yeah, exactly. Of who you are, what you do, and hopefully you get published with Qualy and get the stars aligned.
Let's hope so, man. Let's hope so.
On that note, this one is in the books. Thank you, John.
Thank you, dude.
Thank you for listening to the whole episode. If you like this podcast, please do leave a comment and share the episode. If you want to access the Deconstructor of Fun community with hundreds of senior games folk, go to our website and apply to the Slack group. And if you want to get notified of all the new content we have coming out every week, do subscribe to the weekly Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. Finally, do remember, we love you guys and we appreciate you guys. Catch you next time.